banks are safe. There's enough cash in the financial system. And there is an infinite amount of cash at the Federal Reserve.
And I would sell my Bitcoin right into this rally. And believe me, I hadn't been a believer one time in Bitcoin. Not here, not now.
Arbitrage on this trend has been margin called.
Think you was a hook, trusted your idols, now they got you shook. Believe in the crooks, hell of a saint, while they're cooking the books. Save up a day and I'll set a day. Another November, I'm just getting away. Bigger the bank, bigger rebel the fact. When it all blows up, it is you who will pay.
Behind the ass inside the success. Pull back the curtains and what do you get? And it's the risk with a visit in that. Made from your savings and 401k. Give it to the other side of the trade. Socialize lessons while we've been the game. First to fall in this reckless war. Cause you're just a pawn in the fulfilling this dream.
Money talks and pay for the show. Pay for the crowd, pay for the throne. Pay for the media to lie to our face. Talk the truth so we repeat our mistakes. Sell us the dream but never deliver. While we're here, fees including the tickets. Siphoning funds from the mouthless bigot. Blind leads are blind to the all complicit. Money is cheap and addicted to growth. Commingle the risks so nobody knows. How far ever go to a damaged collateral. Another excuse for oppressive control. And government capture is part of the play. Reapers of value at the end of the day. We're calling for help but nobody came. And bailouts are poor and incomplete.
Money deeply rots at the core. Don't believe intentions are pure. This crypto contagion stems from a system that incentivized fraud. As schemes get more complex and fallible humans left unchecked. Playing the dark is how you get wrecked. And our economies are allotted to X.
What would happen if we take the money out of its systems? Why protest our labor when we can pull out our capital? Where would we be if our money enriched us? Simply by holding purchasing power. How do we build a base? Replace the utility effects with the world of free markets.
Build an independent system to remove the risk of corruption.
Step two.
Move our savings in the best system so no one can ever touch it.
Step three.
Learn, save, spend, trade. All activities move this way. We go home, everything changed. We no longer positive to the
game. The world's tired of our design, earning our work, and we're tired of earning a larger piece of pie for everyone wants to be on by. Money is the army for everyone who wins. That's your score of politicians. It's coming and capturing class and place, and we reap the value at the end of the day.
So we can move value without being sensitive. Move up from gambling to saving. Move up from all the politics. Move on to the end of the internet.
So we don't got the trust to be what they say. So freedom of mind can be taken away.
So we treat and punish all the same.
So we can get to the children's game.
Knowing the truth will break the frame. Now our perspective is forever changed. Truth is the key for us to reclaim.
Open the door, it's the game.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 79 of the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces. I am your host, Coleman, and I want to apologize for the ruckus going outside my door. I have the lawn guys here, so I apologize if there's a lot of background noise going on. Hopefully it's only just a couple more minutes. But I want to say good morning to everybody tuning in. We have Jordan on the Operation Libertas handle up here with me. Good morning, sir.
Morning, Coleman. How you doing?
I am doing really well. Had a fantastic yesterday afternoon. Got a lot of stuff done. I was really proactive. So I was really happy with everything. And we had a fantastic space yesterday morning. We had a ton of people tune in, a lot of first time listeners. I definitely see that we had a lot of people, reach out and start liking our page. So that was awesome. And in case you missed it, we had a really good space talking about MicroStrategy and Saylor and kind of his plan over the next 6 to 12 months. So if you missed it, go back to the link, check it out. It was a really good one. But we also last night had a really good video podcast with Zach from Punchplate. Came in and talked about it. I've only caught bits and pieces. I haven't been able to listen to the whole thing. But there's been a lot of positive feedback about that one. So make sure you go again. I put a link up here in the nest. So go back and give that a lesson as well. I just want to shout out a couple of listeners I see out in the audience. Yomar, you're more than welcome to join up here, sir. Randy K, Texas Toast, Hunter, Wade on the Bitcoin Alaska handle, Def and Bitcoin, Montani, I see you out there, Pete, Jesse, Andy, BitCat, Elder Mark. So good morning to all of you, and I hope you had a fantastic evening. But before we kick this off and we start rolling into this, I want to make sure everyone understands the reason that we do this every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern. And that is to show everybody that we don't need a central authority telling us what we can do, and that Bitcoin is the answer to that. That this decentralized currency can be traded amongst us without any outside help. That if we want to go ahead and transact outside of the traditional quote unquote rails, that we're able to do so, and that there is nobody able to stop us. Not even with this quantum FUD that's going out there. We'll dive into that a little bit today. But again, all of this stuff, again, we're getting to a point where there's really at the moment nothing that can stop Bitcoin and the Bitcoin mission. And so that is why we do this every day, to make sure everybody understands the importance of it and understand the importance of Bitcoin only. We don't shitcoin. I can't stand when people bring up, well, if I can't afford Bitcoin, what should I look at? Should I do XRP? Should I do Ethereum, Doge? No, not any of that crap. All you're going to do is get rugged. And so moving forward, I've tried to make a little pledge, and I'm going to start quoting the price of Bitcoin in Satoshis. So it makes it a lot more appealing to people who are just getting into the space. So at the moment, you can buy 1,007 Satoshis for one U.S. cuckbuck. So almost at that 100,000K mark for Bitcoin. But yeah, I want to make sure that we start doing this. Again, it's just a different framework, and I think it makes it easier for people to jump in there. Mike, I see you out in the audience. I'm going to send you an invite, sir. But Jordan, what are your thoughts on pricing and sats versus the whole Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I've always enjoyed watching the like price of sats for $1 and watching that tick down. You know, people want to talk about Bitcoin going to $1 million. Well, if it one sat becomes $1, that's what, $100 million Bitcoin. And I just think, well, regardless of like where you think the price is going to go, I think it's probably just a better way of talking about how it, the price is, one, it brings that nominal number down and makes it seem more approachable, but it also sells the fact that like a lot of people that aren't in it still don't understand that, you know, a Bitcoin is made up of 100 million sats and it's divisible down. So it kind of, it kills two birds with one stone.
Yeah, and it just makes it an easier entry point for everybody to get in. So I see we have Eomer up here. Good morning, sir. And we got Mike back up here. Good morning, gentlemen. How are your evenings?
Hey, good morning. Just another usual evening, you know, so nothing too special. I did catch, you know, chunks of the video podcast, last night. Which made me like Punch Plate even more. So, definitely give that a watch if you guys have the time. Thought it's great to, you know, see the faces and get to know some of the people behind the companies, especially the ones that are, you know, willing to help sponsor, Bitcoin veterans and, you know, help Bitcoin veterans achieve the mission. So I thought that was a really cool, episode.
Yeah, Mike, this is the first time we had Punch Plan on, or is it the second time?
I want to say it was the first time. Cause there's been podcasts that I've missed, so I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty confident it's the first time that Punch Plate has been on with us. And, yeah, I personally was pretty, like, I was pretty happy that he came on and chatted with us, cause, Zach seemed like it was pretty clear that he was kind of just like nervous about it. And I think he got pretty comfortable with us even just like 15, 20 minutes in. And then he was really comfortable by the end. So I'm hoping he can join us in spaces, going into the future and like share some of his opinions that he's comfortable with sharing. Cause I mean, the other thing I understand too is like being a, being the owner of a company and like trying to make business, you can't really, when you're early on, you can't really afford to let too many of your opinions kind of like destroy the cash flow. So I'm hoping he can join us in the future. It was a lot of fun talking with him last night.
I'm really interested to hear how the tree decorating went, Mike.
Oh, it did not go anywhere. It did not happen at all.
I missed it. There was tree decorating going on last night.
Yeah, I was texting Jordan and Shane immediately, like upon immediate completion of the podcast, we were rolling straight into tree decorating, and then it just didn't happen.
You don't sound very festive, Mike.
I'm just not big on spending the time and energy on Christmas lights when I could be spending it on Bitcoin mining or Bitcoin, you know?
I understand, Mr. Scrooge. I think I'd like to go ahead and start rolling into some of the topics today before we start debating the headline up here, gold for Bitcoin. But it definitely has to be mentioned. Yesterday, Eric Trump went to the Bitcoin conference in the Middle East, North Africa. And he did a 25-minute presentation, so I can't play the whole thing. But I was really impressed with the way he was speaking. During the conference, you can tell that he's more informed, and it seems as there's more public appearances from the Trump administration, Trump himself and his inner circle, it does seem like they've gone down the rabbit hole. I know that they're dabbling in shit coins and they created the Truth Social coin or whatever that is. But listening to Eric speak, at the keynote presentation, it gave me a lot of confidence that he does know what he's talking about and that there is going to be a lot of positive going into this. So one of the big things that I took away from Eric's post, sorry, I got to find it on my sheets here. So he reiterated that Donald Trump wants to add Bitcoin to the U.S. treasuries. In what capacity, we don't know yet, but as this goes through, it will be made more clear. The big headline that I saw was Eric reiterated that Trump wants to make Bitcoin tax-free for transactions. And that, I think, is really big simply because it allows you to transact with it without having to worry about any consequences. So you could really start living on a Bitcoin standard. There were some other takeaways. He talked about the 100K barrier and going through that and how he believes that we'll reach a million per Bitcoin. It's not a matter of if, but more a matter of when we'll do it. And more people are going to start looking. So I think it was really, really interesting. Did anybody up here on the panel see that keynote speech or have any thoughts or takeaways from it? And I just want to welcome, we have Infra that just jumped up here. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, I did, and I had a question for you guys as vets that are familiar with the way that our military leaders and bureaucrats think about things. So it seems to me like they are right. We're clearly in this phase where the world has been buying less and less of our debt. And you know, we're still the strongest country economy and military on earth, but we're clearly fading a bit. If you were, you know, one of these bureaucrats in DC or military leader in DC, and you wanted to reassert dominance, which it seems to me as a layperson is kind of their whole mentality with everything, dominance, strength. It would seem to me that the East and the BRICS countries have been stacking gold at an incredible pace, especially over the past few years. It would seem to me like their thought process is a relative value trade, right? Like from a trader's perspective, it would be a relative value trade, short gold, long Bitcoin, demonetize gold, and therefore, your enemy's wealth. and monetize this new, much smaller asset class. Gold is, I think, an $18 trillion market cap, Bitcoin being about, you know, 1.8 or somewhere around there. It would seem to me it would be pretty easy for the U.S. to relatively quickly monetize Bitcoin and therefore, add kind of spice to that trade, to that idea, selling gold. You know, printing money to buy Bitcoin is kind of half of it. But then if you really wanted to spice it up, you sell your gold, and we have, you know, I think 260 million ounces of gold. And that adds further downward pressure to gold. And then you use those proceeds to buy more Bitcoin. I don't know. It's just kind of a tinfoil. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the leaders, right, that make the decisions. And just kind of curious what you guys think about that.
I don't think bureaucrats are going to take a big, risky swing, and do that. I mean, in my opinion, and based on my beliefs of Bitcoin and gold, I think that would be the smartest move to make. They're not really known for always making the smartest move. They typically make the more conservative move that's based on, you know, in gold's defense, it's got 5,000 years of history behind it, right? So that's kind of a hard thing to just switch up. And yeah, obviously first off, does the U.S. really have all that gold? I guess that would be the first thing, but assume that they do and they start selling it. Yeah, that's downward pressure, but that's not if every other country starts scooping it up. You know, that might, I wouldn't really see that happening, but it could. If every other country still says, nope, we believe in gold, that kind of counteracts. And then I just don't see bureaucrats doing that, because they would play that out and they'd be like, well, what if we're wrong about Bitcoin and then everything, or even take Bitcoin out of it? Just what if we're wrong about gold being worthless and everyone else still thinks it's worthless and we just sold it for nothing and now everybody else has it? So I just don't see that as being a bureaucratic move.
Yeah, I see gold and Bitcoin as they're both, right? Like, none of the bureaucrats want the dollar to go away. Like, even Trump says he doesn't want it to go anywhere. So I see gold and Bitcoin as the, you know, they're a hedge against the dollar going away. You don't want to put your entire hedge in one basket. You know, you don't want to only hedge on Bitcoin. Especially for us, I think it's a different path than a government. You know, the government has a lot of other considerations they have to take, Operation Libertas's point. The part of the goal of these other nations is to, you know, remove power from the dollar. So if the U.S. government sold off all of the gold they have, they could just say, oh, well, it's gold instead of Bitcoin now. We're going to use like some layer on top of gold, and then, you know, we're stuck empty handed. So I don't think it's, it's great, like Bitcoin maximalist talking point, but I don't think it's realistic. I think if we have gold in the reserves, you know, which is a question that some people, you know, get up in arms about. But if we do have that gold in the reserves, I think it's going to stay there. It's a fallback plan to the fallback plan, right? If there's a nuclear winter, maybe then, gold will resume its dominancy over, Bitcoin for the cave people that come in after. I wrote about this a lot in my article, America's Waning Power. I talk about, our gold reserves and our, stolen Bitcoin reserves that we have right now. That's my thoughts on it.
Mike, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I think the most likely strategy forward with the whole gold versus Bitcoin thing is going to be countries and nation states and bureaucrats and leaders kind of just working on accumulating both, or keeping one and accumulating the other. Because like if we're gonna look at the past couple thousand years, as far as like how long fiat currencies have been in like alive and then evolved and rethought and then re-implemented and then destroyed and failed and then done all over again. It's pretty clear that the nation states are going to continue to produce fiat currencies in order to try and like produce debt so they can continue to expand and, you know, fund infrastructure expansion and development and whatever. It's in their best interest to not destroy the original kind of hard commodity that has been accumulated to fund such a practice. And they're going to be most incentivized to keep that one while like the rest of the planet like still values it as far as a hard currency or whatever. And then on the top of that, accumulate anything new that is coming with it, because then they'll benefit from the older generations aging out and still having the mindset, and then benefit from the younger generations having the new mindset with the new asset class, which is what we're talking about is Bitcoin here. And then from there, they can continue to just build their power on top of it. And both of those assets benefit from the endless money printing that we know comes with fiat currencies. And then they can use that power to accumulate more assets, more land, and justify that as backing for the next iteration of the fiat currency. The whole destruction of the gold reserves, I just don't see it as, like, the only thing that would make sense for me would be to, so that they can use gold as an industrial metal for, computers and electronics, which would be, and also space exploration. But like, I don't really see that happening anytime soon.
So I'm going to take the opposite side of this, and I think that it is a really good move if they were to go ahead and demonetize gold and just sell it all. There would be definitely cascading effects, ripple effects, and it would cause a lot of turmoil in the short term, but still allowing gold to be considered a reserve currency or just a reserve asset. You give all of your enemies still the ability to work outside your current system. And so if the United States feels threatened, and I do think they feel threatened, you could see the way Trump's been posturing at the BRICS credits, a currency will tariff them at 200% or whatever he had said with that. With gold still being a legitimate asset, you still give them power. And if you were to come through and just say, look, we're going to go ahead and turn this to zero and we're going to start using Bitcoin, you force everybody to start acquiring Bitcoin. I think we're all in the same belief of that. If the United States actively really starts trying to acquire a significant amount of Bitcoin, every other country is going to be forced to doing that. And a lot of these countries don't have the ability just to print their money to buy it. So they would have to dip into their gold reserves to try and keep up. And if the United States is the first one to do this, it would cause a shift. And I think that is why if they do it and they do it right away, it would be extremely beneficial for the United States, and everybody else would really hurt. And that would include our allies. So Britain, France, Germany, everybody we consider allies, it would hurt them as well, just because they would be in a race to sell the most, the quickest, to get the best dollar for it. So that's kind of my take on it.
And to your point, Coleman, as far as it, anybody that might say, well, we wouldn't do it because of our allies. No, we took all their gold to begin with, so we don't really care that they're our allies. So as far as that part of the argument, I definitely see that.
Wait, sorry. Go ahead.
I have to more align with Coleman, maybe a little bit further on the spectrum. The people buy gold to stick it in a steel box underground and never see it again. It has no utility. There's no use case for it. I've had a claim. I've worked a claim. I have pulled gold out of the earth. I have tried to sell that gold. I have realized how painful it is with assaying it, with shipping it, with trying to get spot for it. Like, It serves very little purpose except for to put it somewhere where nobody ever gets to see it. It just doesn't have any utility. So, and people who don't understand how hard it is to go through that process, I can see them, enjoying the silly yellow metal. But as far as utility aspect, it has none. If the U.S. tried to sell it, I think it'd be difficult in the sense that there's a lot more gold than people realize out there because we don't know what the denominator is. A lot of the gold is shipped into the U.S., you know, under the cover of darkness from places like South America. So there's a lot more gold that exists on the market than people realize. But you always have to find a buyer if you're going to sell, which would quickly drive the price down. I don't think it carries the value that people think it does. If you could find the buyers, if you can't find the buyers, you have to constantly lower the price. But if the buyers are going to be less likely to buy it if they have to pay all these expenses for shipping, security, storage. So you have to constantly drive the price down to get a buyer. That would drive the gold mining industry out of business very quickly. It just doesn't have the benefits that people think it does. That went away. Lynn Alden, you know, one of her, pieces that I really enjoyed was when she was talking about, the fact that gold died with the telegraph, and it did. It serves no purpose today. So I don't think that one, the U.S. could liquidate the gold very easily because they have to find a buyer. It wouldn't drive the cost of gold down, slowly. I think it would be more of a landslide. We wouldn't be able to liquidate the gold before the monetary premium is gone because we don't know how much is actually on the market. So I think it would be a really cool move though, in the sense that once you liquidate it and you eliminate that monetary premium, sure, the U.S. is going to be sitting on a whole bunch of gold, but, and yeah, all the gold bugs will run out and they'll get excited and they'll buy a bunch of gold as it's going down and doesn't ever go back up because it just gets stuck in a steel box in the ground. But yeah, it does demonetize your enemies. So I don't think it's as much of a benefit as in we would get a lot of Bitcoin for the gold, but I think it would be great for demonetizing the gold of your enemies. I do think that's total evil genius.
Yeah, and that argument actually makes me think like they should do it, and maybe they will, because I would think as soon as the U.S. government signals that they're selling all their gold or even starts to sell some of it, the price just starts plummeting, and I don't think they ever find a buyer. So kind of in theory, gold's already worthless. You just have some people still purchasing it and pretending that it's worth something. But the second the U.S. does that, the price drops down and you've already defeated your enemy, even though you'll never be able to offload it. So going back to Coleman's argument, just using it as whether, or that was Mike, using it in, you know, electronics or space exploration, that would probably be the most valuable use of it if we really do have as much as we say we do.
I just wanted to clarify too, like these arguments that I'm putting forward as far as like the, what I think is the potentially most likely strategy, I don't believe them or I don't want them. Like I don't want to keep gold monetized. I think it's one of the dumbest assets out there, but I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of these bureaucrats and these individuals that are very, when we're talking about politics and world leaders, they're almost like, I would think 10, 20 years behind the fringe or the edge thinkers, which are going to be, individuals like ourselves. I want gold demonetized so I can see the electrical infrastructure and space exploration get to where it should have been 20 years ago. And that's being held back a lot of times by the monetization of rare earth metals. But I just don't have faith in world leaders for the next, besides forever, which is probably the most accurate, assumption, at least the next 20 to 30 years that these people aren't going to be able to actually see what the logical step is. So yeah, I just wanted to put that out there. I don't want you guys thinking I'm some weird Bitcoin or gold bug, like having some internal conflict with myself. That would be awful. But I did want to also say, TX, like I want you to get up here and engage, man. Like this, I know that you have some opinions on this like topic, and if you have the capability, like please come up here and engage with us. Cause like I love going back and forth with you, man.
So guys, just real quick, I appreciate the thoughts. I would say, like we see long Bitcoin as a hedge against the dollar. But you know, from a kind of macro standpoint, like what the US needs is they need to recapitalize their balance sheet. When you look at the historical average of how much of our debt is backed by gold or backed by anything, right? It's something, an asset on the balance sheet. The historical average going back to the early 1900s was like 25, 30, 35% of the foreign held US debt, what, you know, was, could be paid off by assets on our balance sheet. Now today that number is like 5.5. And you know, it's clear that the fiscal situation is pretty acute. If we were to print $500 billion a year to buy Bitcoin, and then we all know Bitcoin's CAGR, and its performance, you have this asset on the asset side of your balance sheet that's gradually monetizing, it's gradually accruing value. And it could recapitalize the system and actually ironically bring down treasury yields, which today, I happen to be watching are going up, even though we had a, an inline CPI print. It could actually bring treasury yields down, right? Because there is more on the asset side, you know, the fiscal situation is not as bad. You know, you look at someone coming to you to take out a loan and they got, you know, 100K in debt and 10K in assets. It's a lot different. You're going to give them a different interest rate. That's a different risk than someone that's got, you know, 80K in assets, and 100K in debt. So it could actually bring treasury yields down and it could actually strengthen the dollar. Like we're in this, Trump unfortunately has this really difficult situation where in order to truly reindustrialize and rebuild our middle class, which I 100% support, we need a much weaker dollar. And I think that's going to be his biggest challenge. You know, someone mentioned before the reserve currency and his comments on that. It is the reserve currency status that has hollowed out our middle class and our industrial base. It is the reserve currency status that has prioritized, right, all the trade deficit, which just keeps getting worse and worse by the year. That trade deficit is paid by indebting the country's youth, like me, and I probably like a lot of you guys. We print debt because we need to pay China for all the stuff they're shipping us. So it's indebting our youth. And then those dollars that go to China, go to Taiwan, go to these other countries to pay them for their exports to our country, they reinvest in our capital markets. You know, they keep some as foreign exchange reserves in their central bank, but a lot of that gets pumped back into our capital markets. So you get the situation that we have now where if you're a derivatives trader on Wall Street, you're doing just fine. You know, the S&P 500, you got a ton of, millions of dollars on the stock market. You're doing just fine. But the people that work for a living, the real Americans, the everyday Americans are falling further and further behind. Our wage, the average hourly wage relative to GDP has fallen 54% in the past 40 or 50 years. Like it has just relentlessly been declining. So Trump, you know, I'm not quite sure he understands all these dynamics, but it does, you know, with the dollar's back above 106 and, you know, Europe is dying, like he's inheriting quite the scenario, to navigate because to truly, you know, do his agenda, the dollar needs to be substantially weaker. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
So I want to pull on a couple threads that you had stated there, especially when it comes to the interest rate on our debt. We spend over $1 trillion on the interest every single year, and so we need to get that down. That's just, as James Lavis puts it, it's a debt spiral. One thing that they could do. And I believe Preston Pish or Luke Groman was the first person I heard speak about this, is get the interest rates down to next to nothing. So we're not paying heavily on that, but go ahead and attach a a coupon for Bitcoin. So allocate a percentage of Bitcoin to each bond, and you'd almost have what, and again, I'm sorry for bringing it up, but you're going to have what Michael Saylor's doing with his bonds. He's offering 0% for 3 or 4 years, and at the rate of return, these bonds are oversubscribed. So you could do that in sense with attaching a percentage of Bitcoin to the treasury notes, and you would be able to offset some of our debt. So that would be a step in the direction to kind of help them on that front. So if anybody has any thoughts or comments on that, I'd like to get your take, but I think that's one solution. Yep. Go for it.
Yeah, I do think that that's a fresh idea that we could, it kind of goes back to prior points people were bringing up, like how innovative are the bureaucrats? Is that something that, they would support? The other thing to point out too, when it comes to interest rates is a lot of people don't know this, but like yield curve control, we ran yield curve control in America not too long ago either. After World War II, the last time our debt to GDP was this high, they capped rates at like 2.5%, something like that. And then they ran the nominal GDP, right, counting inflation, at like 18 or 19%. I think CPI at its peak was 16%. And nominal GDP was like 18 or 19%, for a year or two. And so like we've already done it, we had negative real rates of, 10 to negative 15% for a few years here in America. Europe after World War II ran, I think it was negative 30, kind of, ballpark average. And I think Japan was like negative 40. And so we've done it before, and they've already kind of done this soft yield curve control, with Janet Yellen choosing to issue so many bills at the short end of the curve, Stephen Moran and I think it was Rubini did a paper, and they found that that accounts for like 50 basis points on the 10-year, that it's effectively brought the 10-year down. And we know Janet Yellen didn't term out the debt, when she could have, right? Where the U.S. government is essentially financing itself via payday loans, especially with an inverted yield curve, right? Where the rates at least had been, much higher at the front end of the curve. Like that is essentially what the strongest country on earth, we're financing ourselves with payday loans. And it's a sign that all emerging markets going through debt crises, they do the same exact thing. And also it's worth noting that in emerging markets, when they are overly indebted and they start to cut rates and do monetary easing, the longer bonds go up, the yield goes up, even though they're cutting rates. And what has happened since the first rate cut of 50 basis points, the 10-year's up over 60 basis points, right? He brought down rates. And the 10-year, right, it had a little rally over the past week or so, but like the general trend since they've been cutting rates for the longer bonds is up. So like Trump is going to inherit like an acute crisis. Certainly an acute problem, with interest and with it, because as probably everyone knows, the Fed doesn't control the 10-year rate. The Fed doesn't control the 20 or 30 or even the 5. And in fact, the 2-year, they don't even really control that. If anything, the 2-year treasury leads the Fed. Like the 2-year treasury essentially forces the Fed. And you can look at this, pull up a chart of the federal funds rate and then the 2-year rate, on top of each other. And you'll see the 2-year rate essentially dictates the Fed's, overnight rate. So yeah, it is an acute crisis to get the interest down somehow. And I think, yield curve control, we've done it before, not too long ago. Like we could definitely see that again.
And Wade, before I go to you, just really quick, you jog my memory. Someone who really understands this situation that we're in and is in a significant role within the Trump administration is Howard Lutnick. So I would not be surprised to see something, that we might deem is not feasible in the next 20 or 30 years happen in this administration. So again, I've heard Howard Lutnick talk about this, talk about adding Bitcoin to treasuries during some of his speeches. So again, this would be one way to go ahead and do this. And I completely forgot about it until you said something, Infra. So go ahead, Wade.
So I don't understand finance at the deep financial level, but the race to debase can only exist when you can debase. So if you are the first out of the system and you monetize, like if the US purchased a whole bunch of Bitcoin, that drives the value of Bitcoin up. That seems like what Trump is looking at doing. Saylor's hinting at the US doing. So you eliminate the competition. Then you go to a better monetary system that's got better rails. At the same time, you increase the value of the asset that you're purchasing, being Bitcoin, which makes it a lot easier to pay off the debt. Then you could theoretically default on the Fed. Not default against people who you owe money to, but specifically the Fed, and just fire Jerome Powell. I mean, that's a, you know, maybe a dream situation, but it just seems like that's the direction that we could be going. The whole system changes. We had the petrodollar and we controlled that system. So if we want to control the rails of the future, they're going to have to do this at some point. At what point are they going to go ahead and concede and do that? If we don't, then we can't debase forever. And Bitcoin being the absolute measuring stick that it is, once you adopt it, the money printer's off.
Yeah, and just real quickly on that point, is a great point. Scott Bessent, who's the new Treasury Secretary, there's a speech he did on YouTube at the Manhattan Institute. It's about an hour long. I think it was about 6, 7, 8 months ago. And he talked about a global reordering, monetary and trade reordering, not once, not twice, but 3 different times. So I think that's a super important point. You know, we could see a totally new system, like the Treasury Secretary's saying, you know, that we need that. And so, yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, I really like this conversation, gentlemen. It's really thought provoking. And again, there's so much, like, I wouldn't put anything outside the realm of possibility with this administration. I do believe that Trump wants to shake things up, and I do believe that he wants to be someone that makes changes that are lasting, so everyone will remember that he's the president that did this. And doing some of these things that they may be, you know, thought radical right now may not be so much with the people that he's put in there. Again, Scott Bessent and Howard Lutnick, man, they could really make some positive changes out there. So, but we have TX that joined the stage. I just want to say good morning before we go ahead and get your thoughts on things. I want to give a quick thank you to our partners, Black Sheep Ammo. Restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com. Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms and tactical training at paladintowertactics.com. Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. Use the code BTCVETS with an S for 5% off your order. And if you pay in Bitcoin, there's an additional 10% off, so potential for 15% off your order. Go to solosatoshi.com. And last but not least, I see Punchplate in the audience. Everybody give a thumb up, a fist pump to Punchplate. Self-custody your Bitcoin. You need to put that seed phrase on a metal plate. Go to punchplate.com to check them out. And if you missed it last night, we had them with Zach on the video podcast. There's a link up in the Nest. Go give that a listen. And let's go support our sponsors or our partners here on BV. So TX, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for letting me come up here. Mike said my name while I was listening and thought I would come up. I don't like doing a lot of spaces these days, but I don't mind coming to chat for a little bit. I think it's an interesting conversation you guys are having. I certainly have opinions, and I I am a very opinionated person, but I just wanted to be clear that like when I give it a view, if I disagree here, it's just my opinion. I'm not going to pretend like I know better than anyone. I just spend an autistic amount of time looking at some of this stuff. You know, you guys were talking about yield curve control, and I know it's a popular idea these days because the debt situation mirrors the 1940s, but I really think that a yield curve situation would be very difficult for the U.S. to pull off now, in part because of how different the system is today versus the Bretton Woods system of the 1940s. And the reasons I think that would be hard are in part because, if you recall, in the 1940s, there was no private ownership of gold. There were capital controls across most of the developed world in the wake of World War II. And just the free movement of capital was significantly restricted. And at the same time, at that moment in time, the U.S. was the sole solvent power in the world after World War II. And the incumbent global reserve issuer, which was the UK at the time, was our closest ally, and they shepherded a peaceful transition into a new monetary system where we were at the center, and we were the only solvent power at the time. So we were able, in a sense, to run effective yield curve control for about 8 or 9 years before we had to stop. And I think that that situation would be very difficult for us to duplicate today, with the free movement of capital that we have, with the fact that we are now fully embedded as the global reserve currency. The treasury is the global reserve asset. And we have private ownership of gold. We have Bitcoin. We have a much more interconnected global financial system. I think that would just be very difficult. I think we're far beyond elegant solutions, and that wasn't even that elegant. It was kind of a brute force solution to massive war debts from World War II. Those are my thoughts on yield curve control. I'll stop. I won't get into the strategic reserve stuff yet in case someone has like a comment or a question about that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I should mention, like, I personally see, it's not what I want, but I personally, you know, believe that we will see much stricter capital controls in the near future. It's like we're referring to it. You essentially need a much stricter China-esque control on the flow of capital in order to do it. You know, it's not like I agree with you that it's probably not the most likely. I think that the likelihood is not zero. And I think it's probably above 10 or 20%. But personally, I think that the strategic reserve strategy is more likely, in a probabilities, scenario, because you don't need as strict of capital controls, because the world is much more multipolar now. And it's just, right. Like, I think it politically, it's a lot easier for a bunch of bureaucrats to sell, hey, we're going to, you know, we're running a $2 trillion deficit every single year. We're going to just print, you know, $400 billion, $500 billion, some, you know, essentially trivial number when you compare it to the size of the deficit. And hey, maybe they go, hey, every dollar we cut from government waste with Doge, every dollar we cut, we're going to put into this new asset that accrues, you know, 60 something, 70% CAGR. Therefore it's a lower risk strategy, because you're only taking savings from, right. I just think it's like a much more soft, way to try to recapitalize the balance sheet. But yeah, curious what you think.
I think when it comes to the Doge thing, I think if the purpose is to reduce government waste, that we can't go repurposing dollars of savings achieved by Doge while we're still running massive deficits. That we're not saving anything. We're just moving the money around. We're just kind of playing shell games with it. So my initial reaction to what you said there wasn't
necessarily to shoot down the ideas of what you'd use the money for, but just the concept that like, if we're going to have Doge saving money, that we should then find purposes to use that money. The purpose of the whole office being created was to reduce government spending. So I think that there's some conflicts of interest with that idea.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And, you know, personally, I also see Doge being much more difficult for them. I did some, just a little bit of kind of back of the napkin math. And if they enact the cuts that Vivek has been talking about, either Vivek or Elon, I can't remember, these $2 trillion of cuts, right? It would bring the deficit to zero. Sounds great. But when you do the math on that, that takes our GDP, it would result in a contraction of GDP.
Yes.
On par with the GFC, you know, if not COVID. It kind of depends what multiplier you use, but you know, that would be a lot of short-term pain. And I think again, you know, Trump is inheriting quite the mess.
Yeah.
I personally think we should take some short-term pain, you know, and rinse out the leverage, just like we see on Bitcoin, right? We get these crazy wicks to rinse out leverage. You need that in an economy. I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, you know, the thing I'll just say about Doge, and I see someone else have their hand up, is that the thing that they're going to have difficulty with is that the president cannot grant authority to a new government office. It has to come from Congress. So the president has essentially created a toothless consultancy and assigned two billionaires to run it. And so what they're able to do is suggest things. But there is actual no mandated authority that anyone has to listen to them. So I'm kind of hesitant to get excited about it. I think it'll be very interesting for the national discourse about what we spend money on if they actually do some of the work and present some findings. But their ability to enforce any of their ideas is up for major question.
I just got to chime in. I find this hilarious that we had hard assets and we had to print money to create the rails so that we'd have a monetary system that was functional. Then we create a monetary system, engineer it perfectly so we have a system that's running on the rails. Now we have an old system which is that money printer that failed, that we're now going to back that system, that's the failed system, with the new system, basically saying that this new system is not as good as the old system, or it doesn't integrate as well. I don't know. I see Bitcoin more like its own nation, and that it's a perfect monetary system backed by a government of the people who adopt it. And the fact that the U.S. thinking of buying it for a reserve asset, it just gives it more credibility that the U.S. is saying that it's the best nation on earth. So we're going to back our dollar with Bitcoin, just like other nations use the US dollar as a reserve currency. So I find these conversations kind of, I just don't understand the finance world as well as you guys do. And you guys are way further down the rabbit hole in that regard than I am.
So really quick before Eomar or Jordan, you guys go, I think what Wade said is important to realize and take a step back and take a 360 degree view of everything going on and the way that the Trump administration is posturing itself. Like again, Howard Lutnick, Bessonette, and then just listening to Eric Trump speak at the Bitcoin MENA conference. Again, these aren't just talking points. He's not just reading off a slide. Like these people really understand the significance of this and all of these people understand the situation that the United States is in with their debt and everything going on. So just again, as we talk about this, it seems far reaching, but I do believe it's a lot closer than a lot of people give credit for it. So Jordan or Eomar, if you guys want to go ahead, I see your hands up.
I just want to say quick, even though Doge doesn't have any power, right? If you remember Vivek's campaign trail, like most of his plans were to do things through the power of the executive branch, like so through the presidency. So the catch is if Trump actually listens to him, right? There's no way to know if he actually will do that. But you know, the thing I liked about Vivek is that he actually had a plan on how to get like these cuts done. So I hope that it'll go through, you know, like Doge is where I'm resting most of my hope on the next, for the next administration at this point. You know, the foreign policy ship has sailed. But if we fix enough domestically, then, you know, we have a chance. And I think that rests on Doge. So I think we'll find out soon. I don't think, you know, if we don't see any movement in the first like 100 days or so, then we'll know it's just another, lame duck administration that won't get anything done. But if we see him come in and, you know, take the proverbial chainsaw to things, then we have a fighting chance. So that's my thoughts on it.
I just wanted to go back to the comment about, you know, Doge and job cuts and all that stuff affecting GDP. Like, I get that, and that very well could damage the economy. But in real terms, in real productive terms, government spending being part of GDP is just silly. Like, they're not actually producing anything that helps the economy move along. So just because the U.S.'s GDP goes down based on a faulty number, that's like looking at, to me, it's like looking at the inflation numbers and understanding that they're BS. But, so I just wouldn't put a lot of stock into that. That doesn't mean firing a bunch of government employees wouldn't have some effects on the economy, but I just wouldn't care too much about what GDP is doing.
And so if you wanted to counter that, Jordan, and like offset the amount of government jobs you're going to eliminate and the effect it'd have on GDP, you'd want to stimulate more growth in manufacturing in the United States. And it's very funny because Trump yesterday on his Truth Social website made this statement: any person or company investing $1 billion or more in the United States will receive fully expedited approvals and permits, including, but in no way limited to, all environmental approvals. Get ready to rock. So again, they see this. They can see the effects that are going to happen, and I think they are trying to offset the negative consequences. And I've said it before, I'm going to say it again. The first 3 to 6 months of this administration is going to look like a train wreck. With the amount of changes that they're doing, it's going to have a negative impact, I believe, on the economy and on the citizens. But outside of that 3 to 6 month window, you're going to see this country just on a tear. And that's why I believe they're going to do this so quickly, because they can see that it needs that 12 to 16 months for everyone to really feel the effects in a positive way.
Hey, real quick, Coleman, I just wanted to say, I see Bill Stebbins in the audience, and I wondered if he wanted to come out, and it'd be good to get his take on some of the stuff.
Yeah, open an invitation. Send me a request real quick. I'll bring you on stage, sir.
You know,
hey guys, I just want to agree, you know, like when I talk about GDP contracting, I agree that it's an incredibly faulty metric where 35-something percent, I think it's 37% at last quarter, 37% of our quote unquote economic output is just government spending money we don't have. I mean, that is insane. But you know, like you said, there are, you know, GDP is not the best measure, but it certainly, like, if they're talking about cuts on the scale that they are, which I think would be great, like I would support. It's just, what is the American appetite for short-term pain? I agree that, you know, you can offset that with deregulation, negative real rates, you know, just plug in negative real rates again. You know, that you could use that as a tool to encourage, you know, business development, and you know, reindustrialization. You kind of have the two benefits to it. And then the other quick thing I just say is, like, on a global scale, you know, I personally think that we are going to see, I don't want to call it a recession, but we're certainly seeing a slowdown and softening, in the economy, not just here, but I mean, Europe's essentially been in a recession for, you know, many months, if not a year or more. I think that, like, you know, in the relatively near future, even before Trump gets to do anything, we could already be headed towards, you know, a slowdown or even a recession, And you know, delinquency rates are showing that. Unemployment, in my opinion, the way that I look at unemployment is showing that. It's really unfortunate, but I think, you know, if Trump inherits essentially a recession, you know, it's like, I think it's a different calculus if he inherits an already weak economy, you know, versus, hey, we're going to make all these radical changes. Got to take some short-term pain, but it's going to make America better for the long run. You know, I think that calculus is different. So that's the only thing I'd say.
Yeah, I think Doge has an uphill battle, you know, because like whenever we have debates about government spending, like that the wiggle room is like 15% of 30% of the budget, you know, like we're talking about a slice of a slice, because the vast majority is eaten up by defense and entitlements. And those are things no one wants to touch because there's no political appetite to touch them. And the voters are not demanding those things be touched. So we really kind of paint ourselves into a box about what we can actually reduce. And a lot of the noise that gets made, you were right about how much government spending is contributing to GDP in this last few years, particularly. And alongside all of those rumblings, you know, you see on Twitter a lot, these charts about how government employment is exploding while private hiring is going down. And if you look into those numbers, I think that this will come up as a narrative during the Doge stuff. It's like, why are we paying all these government workers? Let's just take a hacksaw to it. Well, if you look at the share of government workers that are federal, it's like 12%. Most of them work for state and local governments. So Doge isn't going to go taking a hacksaw to all that shit. So I just like, just saying this stuff for perspective, because it's going to get really noisy in the next, like, you know, 9 months or so when they get into office and they start going and doing all their research and they start bringing up all these talking points. And so we're going to have a lot of national debates about what we should spend on, what we shouldn't. And there's people already proposing that they just go in and just start firing all kinds of government workers, like with a big hacksaw. And we're talking about the economic effects of doing that. I don't think it's going to be as easy.
Did anybody else see the press conference with Milei in Argentina though? Cause I think that could be a narrative too. I agree with what you said, but I also think, you know, he's shown some success. And I think, you know, there's a reason a lot of these, you know, the electorate are electing, you know, people like Trump, like the lady in Italy and like Milei in Argentina. And so I wonder how much they'll be able to use that as a narrative.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing.
Well, yeah, and it worked in Argentina. It worked, right? It had great results. So I think that's a great point. And I think, you know, hey guys, look at Argentina. Look how great it went for them.
But really quick, well, picture.
A different setup though. You know, there are different country entirely. They had way less inflation than us and a significantly weaker economy. So like it just where it's not an apples to apples, but Milei has done an impressive job.
No, he has. And just for,
and it is,
we need to give context for everyone who doesn't understand what you're talking about, Bob. So if you want to just give a little context as to what Milei, his statement he made that was so significant.
Yeah, sorry, I joined late and I apologize. I'm in the vehicle, so if you hear a little bit of noise. But yeah, for the audience, Argentina is totally set up differently. I'll give you that. But it is a G20 nation and that's important. What I'll say is about what I saw about his press conference was he basically was stating that Argentina has stabilized their currency, the Argentinian peso. The inflation is not as big of an issue as, you know, it once was. And historically, you know, their currency has failed multiple times. Additionally, they're running this without deficits. And if you look at what Milei did, he came in and just basically slashed nearly every department. Some he completely got rid of. So I think, you know, the point's well taken that it is a completely different situation than, you know, what we have in the United States. But I do think that there is an appetite for common sense And I think this just ongoing fiscal deficits that we have in the United States is really, something that needs to be tackled. We all know, but I think there's an appetite for it. And, you know, people's opinions may differ. That's fine. We'll see, you know, if an unelected, or I guess I shouldn't say unelected, but a new department that hasn't existed before will have much effect. But I think, they'll at least be able to make some suggestions to the president, who can then, you know, maybe, with Congress enact some change. So we'll have to see.
And really quick before we go to Jordan or Wade, I think it's significant to note that in the first 6 months, so it's almost been a year since Milei has been elected in Argentina. And in the first 6 months, it was kind of chaotic. A lot of people didn't like the changes. There was just a lot of pushback. But now that it's had its time to just kind of mature and correct itself, things are running a lot smoother. So again, we are completely different than Argentina, but this does serve as kind of a nice little backdrop to look at and kind of you can foresee how the coming changes will take place here in the United States. So Wade or Jordan, I see your hands up. Go for it.
I just like to say things and relate them to other things. Like, so the U.S. dollar is the world reserve currency. Then you've got Bitcoin. But so right now, relative to the U.S. dollar, and you look at Bitcoin, the U.S. dollar is to Bitcoin as is Argentina, and their monetary debasement is to the U.S. dollar. So when we try to pay back our debt in, like, if Argentina was to try and pay it back in whatever their peso is, how long would it take? Like, you look at Michael Saylor, and he talks about how many hundreds of millions of dollars they'd have to make over, a $1 million company would have to make over 20 years in order just to break even. And that's kind of where I see the dollar as being at. Maybe I'm wrong about that viewpoint, but it just seems like as my view of Bitcoin is that it's its own nation. It just, the countries that adopt Bitcoin, they have the benefits of the network, just like other nations have the benefits of the network when they adopt the dollar. So maybe I'm wrong on that viewpoint, but that's just something I wanted to express.
Thank you for that, Wade. Jordan, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, we're talking about, you know, if all these potential federal job cuts could hurt the economy or whatnot, and to what degree. It's all kind of silly to even have that argument when we know that, like, the current spending is unsustainable and the government continues to acknowledge that. So it's like, yeah, compared to what? Like, it might hurt a little bit now, but as opposed to just letting it completely collapse down the road.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, they, you know, I don't know how much of it was malice, but they have left Trump with, like, one of the worst situations, no matter which part you look at. You know, it's like, it's quite the cluster for Trump to be inheriting. I mean, even Yellen, just yesterday, Secretary Yellen said, like, you know, the deficit's unsustainable, fiscal is unsustainable. It's like, excuse me? I agree. And, you know, I'm not, when I bring those points up, like, I try to just think, I try to be as objective as possible, not look at everything how I want it to be, but just how kind of the predominant consensus does view things. You know, GDP is our metric for better or for worse. You know, the left and the mainstream media will certainly use those metrics when there is inevitable short-term pain. You know, I think the strategy against, you know, the movement against Trump, you know, we know how strong that can be. And if the economy is, you know, not perfect to their liking, I think they'll go full court press. I mean, we already see it with MSNBC. In the past 2 days or 3 days, they've done like two full segments about how horrible Bitcoin is. You know what I mean?
Well, and to kind of bolster your point, I think it was either yesterday or the day before on Biden's Twitter account, basically said how, you know, most economists, which they mean like most government economists, think that this is the best economy in world history, and that's what we're leaving the next administration. And so, which no, I don't think your average person believes that. And so you already see that they're setting it up to be like, we have done everything so well, so great. And so that can be a weapon that they use to go after Trump is when everything starts to fail, because it's not like it's really going all that well now. And they can certainly tank it if they want to. They'll just blame it all on him, Doge, job cuts. Like, so, you know, as much as we're talking about this GDP and will it hurt, and regardless of like what it really does, it's going to be used as propaganda talking points.
I mean, like, it's pretty standard boilerplate for the new president to blame all the shit going on the last president. So I think that that's totally going to happen. The same way Biden blamed everything on Trump and Trump blamed everything on Obama 8 years ago. And I think, like, Trump's being handed a very difficult situation, but I don't really know that he's going to be able to do very much about it. And I don't blame it all on the last 4 years. Not that you did. You're not putting words in your mouth. But some of the discourse nationally is, wow, the Dems really fucked us and Trump's got to save us. And it's like, nah, man, some of this stuff's been building for like 30 years. And it's just, we're kind of getting.
Well, that, and Trump also signed the giant spending bill that he bragged about. Yeah. So he's to blame for the inflation almost as much, if not more than.
Yeah. Time. Both of them contributed to the massive post pandemic spending, both of them. And they each have had mistakes. They each, you know, might have some redeeming qualities. It doesn't really matter to me. I think we're on a pretty unalterable trajectory globally and as a sovereign. And I don't think any one administration is really going to be able to change those things. They might be able to slightly alter the way some things feel in the short term, but I don't think they're going to be able to really repair the debt situation, resolve our deficit spending, which is basically embedded in perpetuity because of the design of our system, and no one wants to fuck with entitlements. And so I don't see a lot of elegant solutions. And when I say that, I get accused of being like a doomer and a gloomer and having like nothing positive to say. But I think like when you view these things as long cycles, like multi-generational cycles, we're just kind of in the shit point of that, right? And we have to go through a period of tumult and change because society doesn't pragmatically look ahead to problems and then go, hey, we see this thing coming down the road. Maybe we should make some better choices now. That's like not ever how it plays out. Usually we just run headfirst into the wall and then we all look around and go, okay, now what? And I think we're kind of heading towards that kind of moment for our lifetimes, similar to the way that people had a moment like that in the 30s and 40s. And it looked different to whatever our thing might look like. But I really kind of, that's how my perspective is shaped when I come at these problems. Like we can talk about tactical solutions and maybe he makes a spending cut here or he does a tariff there or he does some, you know, stuff with Doge. But I don't think any of that really will materially improve the fiscal situation for the U.S., or the debt situation, our likelihood to continue spending more than we make. And so that's my perspective on it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope, right, like what I want to have happen is for him to come in and just say, you know, I don't care what I break. We're here's an across the board tariff of, you know, 30%. We're going to make America great again. We're going to bring a real productive economy. We're going to bring, you know, I put a chart in the Nest, like it is incredible how significantly the average American's wages have fallen versus GDP. Where does all that GDP, where has it been going? It's been going to the top 0.1%.
Bingo.
And the bankers and the capital markets. Like what I want, I agree with you that I think we're in that kind of fourth turning into the first turning kind of scenario. And if people are not familiar, Neil Howe, as well as Peter Turchin, they write about these big secular demographic cycles that are driven, you know, by demographics. And some of the stuff in Peter Turchin's book, Ages of Discord, like will blow your mind. This has been going on for these cycles have been going on for like 1,000+ years. Like some of this stuff is real. It's like a glacier. it moves incredibly slowly, but it's very, very powerful. And so, yeah, I hope that we do seize this. It's certainly going to be volatile no matter what. But I certainly hope we seize it, embrace the volatility, just like, you know, Bitcoiners and traders, like embrace the volatility. It's not a bad thing. And really enact some structural change.
I'm so glad you brought up that book. I hadn't heard of Peter Turchin's book, and I was just looking at it. Is it like, was it written after the Neil Howell wrote The Fourth Turning, or was it before?
It's, it was written, let me see, 2016.
Okay, cool. But, yeah, I'll check that one out.
Yeah, definitely recommend it. And, you know, it's not as publicized as The Fourth Turning. Yeah. But it's got some really great stuff in there.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you look around, like,
I just need to add real quick that William Strauss was the real, mind behind The Fourth Turning. Neil Howe, if you read his follow on book, he's kind of trash.
Oh yeah. I have that one on my shelf and I haven't cracked it open yet. I've been I have like a backlog of books to read, and I put that one at the end of the list.
Night and day, leave it in the end of the list.
Yeah, I feel like I on the topic of The Fourth Turning thing, you know, like, you can kind of see the machinations globally. Like, there is a big lurch towards populism and just kind of social restlessness around the world. Like, we here in America, you know, we get very focused on what's going on here. But the political transformation that we've kind of been going through the last, you know, a few years, couple administrations, has been happening everywhere. And like, there was a chart in the Financial Times, I just tweeted it this morning, that every developed country saw its incumbent party lose voter share for the first time in history, that it happened across the developed world. And when you study these big demographic, these multi-generational cycles, that's kind of what starts to happen when you get near the end of the sustainability of the status quo. You know, the pressures build over generations and they keep getting patched over. And eventually you just kind of reach a point where the traditional rails don't work for enough people that they either demand or force change. And it's usually a very volatile period. I brought up the 30s and 40s. That's what it looked like the last time. It doesn't mean we're going to have a Great Depression and World War III, but it could be something similar to that that's very stressful and causes a lot of change globally in ways that we can't foresee. And when you just kind of like look around at the political landscape, the geopolitical instability, the bifurcation of East and West, which is mainly US and China, kind of creating these two economic poles, and you have all of these countries now talking about the need to drive local investment and rebuild their own infrastructure and pull capital back in. This is a very different world from the world from the 1980s to the 2010s. And I think that we are just now beginning to start to see the dominoes fall, and we don't have any idea what's in store, but I think it's a 10-year, at least from this point, process, I would guess.
Well, that was a really good take. I do appreciate that, gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and start wrapping up the show. I'm going to give everybody a last chance. If you have something just to say or to cover that you feel like you need to get off your chest, now's the time. Otherwise, I'm going to start wrapping it up.
Yeah, I would just say real quick, like, you know, I just want to see the people win, right? Like, I want to see America, a normal, real American, you know, people. They're just trying to make a good living for their family. Like, I really hope that we are able to finally see the system work for us, and not the top 0.1% and the bankers and the capital markets. I think we got a shot right now. And I think, you know, it's important whether you voted for Trump, you know, we got to be objective. We got to be critical when criticism is needed, because we might not get another shot. Like, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think if we all, you know, continue to press and fight the good fight, like, I think we really could see huge, huge structural change that will benefit America, right? I love America. I love my country. I love my fellow Americans. I want to see us succeed, you know? But it's going to take, you know, objective, criticism when it's needed and perseverance.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, and again, that's a great way to finish it off, Emperor, because we do stress this every time we start the show, is that this is what Bitcoin is. Again, it allows you to escape the system, and it's not designed from the top up. It's from the bottom down, and it relies on hard work. It's never given. And again, when it does work, it allows freedom to a level that a lot of people we've just never experienced before. And you can literally do anything. You get back one of the most scarcest things, and that's your time. So again, I think it was a great discussion today, a great debate. I really do appreciate it. I appreciate everybody who joined us. AC, Bob, Mike, Jordan, Wade, TX, and Infra. Thank you guys for joining. Join us again tomorrow. We're doing this every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. And if you missed the video podcast last night, we had Punch Plate join us on the video pod. So I haven't looked the whole thing through, so I'm going to listen to that this afternoon. But there's a link up in the Nest. Go ahead and click it and give it a good listen. It was a great, heard some great things about the conversation. Tomorrow we're going to have a fellow BVer joining the space with Compass Coffee. So it'll be a great conversation talking about how Bitcoin has helped him and his company and how AI has played a crucial role in helping him achieve his success in life. So that'll be again tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. That's all I have for y'all. Get out there. Have fun playing with your Bitcoin, to quote Trump. But again, one of the things that I took away from Natalie Brunell's show last Friday was a lot of people are not going to remember your message, but they are going to remember the way you delivered it. So make sure when we're talking about it, we have patience. We're calm, we're cool, collective, and we're understanding. So that's it. Don't shitcoin though. It's like watering a plant that's already died.
Thanks for having me up, guys. See y'all later.